Hello, I'm John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation, and welcome to the audio commentary for From Russia with Love. On this audio commentary, we will be hearing from director Terrence Young, actors Walter Gotell, Martine Beswick, and Alicia Gurr. From the crew, we will hear from composer John Barry, editor Peter Hunt, production designer Sid Kane, sound effects editor Norman Wansdall, special effects supervisor John Steers, and from Dana Broccoli, wife of producer Tuppy Broccoli. The stories which you are about to hear reflect the personal recollections and opinions of those who provided the interviews. Some comments have been edited for time and clarity. They are not meant to provide the definitive history of the film. We begin with the first true pre-title sequence of the James Bond movies. This scene was filmed on the nights of April 16th and 17th, 1963, in what is called the Renaissance Garden at Pinewood Studios outside of London, England, with reshoots filmed in mid-June. Director Terrence Young, in an interview recorded in the early 1970s by Steve Morey, talks about how this scene came about.
The producer, Harry Saltzman, in my mind, is a producer who is very interesting to work with because he has some of the worst ideas I've ever listened to in my life, but he has also some of the very best. And your problem is to persuade him the bad ideas are bad and the good ideas are good. That's your major problem. He had the idea of killing James Bond before the credit title started, which I think is a splendid idea. He wanted to do it in a training school, you know, like the Spartacus training school. And we used that, having built the set, we used that for a later sequence. And I transported it completely into a garden, and I shot it at night so it looked rather faintly like L'année dernière, Marianne Bad.
Actor Walter Gotell, whom we will shortly meet on screen, appears in 7 Bond films. For 6 of those films, he plays General Gogol, head of the KGB. Here he plays Spectre Agent Morsny. He remembers shooting this scene.
The teaser was shot in the maze. And in the teaser, somebody was playing Bond, crouching about the place, until he was suddenly garroted. And as he fell, a mask of James Bond was pulled off his face. And when the rushes were seen the next day, they found that the man the mask was torn off from looked exactly like Sean Connery. So it had to be shot again.
Exactly 1:52. It
just shows how stupid directors are. I had to go back and reshoot the close-up because we got a man who looked vaguely like Sean Connery. And an awful lot of people thought it was Sean Connery, that they were just taking a rubber mask off Sean Connery. So I had to go back and shoot a man with a moustache.
Welcome to Spectre Island. The pulling off of the James Bond mask is a great moment, which immediately lets the audience know they are entering a strange and different world. According to director Terrence Young, this teaser, or pre-credit scene, was producer Harry Saltzman's idea. Saltzman felt it would be interesting to see James Bond killed at the opening of the film. This idea became somewhat of a theme in many of the early Bond pre-title sequences. In Thunderball, we open with a casket draped with a shroud initialed JB, which turns out to be the initials of a Spectre agent. And You Only Live Twice, Bond is killed in the bed of a Hong Kong double agent, or so it seems. It is really a ruse to throw off Bond's enemies. In Diamonds Are Forever, the device is reversed. Bond kills the villain in the first few minutes, until we later find out that it was the villain's surgically enhanced double who was murdered. In The Man with the Golden Gun, the last film with which Harry Saltzman was involved, we once again see a false 007, as in From Russia with Love, this time in the form of a mannequin in Scaramanga's Funhouse. In the original script, these titles were meant to open the film, but in the editing, Peter Hunt and Terrence Young found they liked the idea of the teaser scene before the titles, a concept which obviously quickly developed into a highly anticipated part of the James Bond films. The belly dancer, whose body serves as a screen for Robert Brown John's titles, is the same person who appears in the Gypsy Camp sequence. She worked under the name of Leela, but her full name at the time was Leela Garol. Now let's meet editor Peter Hunt, a key member of the creative team of the early 007 films, who recalls how title designer Robert Brown John became involved with James Bond.
Brown John was a find of Harry's. He was a Canadian. Harry was a Canadian. Brown John had worked all the time in commercials and things like that. It was Harry who brought him in as something new and something brilliant and wonderful. Brandon was a fun man, nice man. I liked him a lot. He did Goldfinger as well.
Another key player in the success of From Russia with Love is composer John Barry, who is responsible for the thundering, sensual sounds of this title sequence overture. He talks about how he became involved in the film after arranging the James Bond theme on Dr. No.
I never saw anybody on Dr. No. The only person I saw was Noel Rogers, who is United Artists Music. I never saw anybody from the movie. And it wasn't until From Russia with Love that Noel called me and said, I want you to meet them. And that was the first time I met Jimmy Broccoli and Harry Saltzman and Peter Hunt. And though I'd had instrumental hits, I hadn't had a song hit. I'd accompanied song hits on records, but I hadn't actually written a hit song. They decided they wanted a song over the opening titles. And Lionel Bart had just written Oliver and had a huge, huge hit with Oliver in the West End. So they called Lionel Bart, and I knew Lionel as well. And Lionel wrote From Russia with Love, and I arranged it and orchestrated it for the movie and did the rest of the score. It was a big hit with Matt singing at Matt Monroe.
Night.
Thanks,
Bishop.
This sequence takes place in Venice, but it is actually shot on a set on D stage at Pinewood Studios. This scene was filmed during the first week of shooting and features one of production designer Sid Kane's most elaborate sets, including a marble floor, which features a chessboard pattern. The day this was shot was also the first day of rehearsals for a young actress, Alicia Gurr, who plays Vida, one of the gypsy fighting women featured later. Gurr remembers her reaction to the set.
I remember walking with Lotta Lenya in the morning. We both left the makeup room and we walked on the set. And the two of us went, wow, you know. And Lotta said to me, that is one spectacular set. And we were both sorry that we were not in that shot. As a matter of fact, seeing that set, I then was adamant to learn how to play chess.
Alicia Gurr won the role of Vida after appearing in the short-lived musical Ramona in London's West End. Harry Saltzman saw the play and liked Gurr's performance and asked her to become part of the James Bond cast. Terrence Young pulled together a wonderful supporting cast for From Russia with Love. Here he talks about two actors who turn in tremendous performances.
Rosa Klebb was an idea I had absolutely out of the blue, because we were originally thinking in terms of using Katina Paxino. But there was some reason we couldn't get her. She was in a play in Athens and it didn't work. So I had just been given about 2 days earlier a new gramophone record, a disc called River's End, I think it was. And there's old Lottie singing and Lottie standing on the outside. And I said, why don't we try her? Well, I had to go over and see her. And she's not a young girl at all, but she's full of life. And she's a marvelous, marvelous character. And she said it would be terrific fun. I said, it was going to be a very tough picture for you, you know. But she was delighted with the idea of doing the picture. Kronstein, I wanted somebody whose face would be very memorable. That's to say, very often in a picture you have a big problem in reminding an audience who a certain character is if he only makes in 3 or 4 appearances. And I stumbled by accident on this Polish actor, Szabal. He went later into a film of Russell's called Women in Love. And he's had quite a big career ever since From Russia with Love. This was his first film part. He'd been an extra or something before. But he had a great face. He looked intelligent. He looked intellectual enough to be a chess champion. And as I said, he had a very distinctive face. Fortunately, it's something else. He had one of the most marvelous voices I've ever listened to. He had a great, great voice. One of the best voices I've ever heard. And he only had to come on, and everybody said, ah, yes, the chess player. You know, there was no problem about that.
This scene includes a wonderful assortment of actors. To play Blofeld, Terrence Young asked Anthony Dawson, who played Professor Dent in Dr. No, to sit in the chair and pet the cat. Actor Eric Pullman provided the voice of Blofeld in post-production. Both men would repeat their roles in Thunderball 2 years later. Anthony Dawson worked with Terrence Young on They Were Not Divided, a film that also introduced Young to Welsh actor Desmond Llewellyn, who we will meet later. Dawson is best remembered for his role in Dr. No and his performance as the shifty-eyed hired killer in Alfred Hitchcock's 3D masterpiece, Dial M for Murder. Austrian actor Eric Pullman had the perfect voice for Blofeld. By the time of From Russia with Love, Pullman was often being cast as portly villains. He had become famous in Austria in the late 1930s for his stage work. After the Nazis rose to power, Pullman escaped to London, where he worked for the BBC's Overseas Service, a strong propaganda weapon for the Allied cause. He can be seen in many great films of the late 1940s and 50s, including The Third Man, Mogambo, Moulin Rouge, Lust for Life, Anastasia, and a number of films produced by Albert R. Cubby Broccoli before the producer began making Bond films. Pullman appeared in many London theater productions, including The Threepenny Opera, which brings us to his co-star, another performer famed for her memorable voice, Miss Lotta Linja. In 1928, Lotta Linja, then married to composer Kurt Weill, debuted as Jenny in the Threepenny Opera. She became an immediate sensation across Germany, and her husband's royalties from the music made the pair wealthy. Linja and Weill moved to New York to avoid the Nazis. After Weill's sudden death in 1950, Linja had a huge career singing the songs of her late husband and his collaborator, Bertolt Brecht. For those who might only know her from this film, it is hard to imagine her tremendous talent and stage presence. She wowed audiences across the globe. When Louis Armstrong recorded an English-language version of the most famous song from the Threepenny Opera, Mack the Knife, he added a new name to the list of victims of the title character's murderous temper, Miss Lotta Linja. This sequence is a combination of Ian Fleming's novel and a suggestion from producer Harry Saltzman. Saltzman had seen the film Spartacus and liked the idea of the gladiator training school. He wanted to see Spectre agents training for their missions in the same brutal fashion, but updated for modern times. The result is a wonderfully macabre set by Sid Kane in the Gardens of Pinewood Studios. Sound engineer Norman Wanstall recalls how he added some reality to the sound effects in this sequence.
With the men at the training school, you hear voices and it creates an atmosphere. Without them, it's a totally different effect. That's where I could add to a scene where perhaps no one had really thought of doing it before, which was something I learned from Wynne Ryder. He was a great fan of doing this, and I learned how he brought scenes alive just by having distant voices.
Peter Hunt and Terrence Young play a trick on the audience here. To make the training camp look larger, they show us this long shot for the actors walking into another section. It is, of course, the same set, filmed from a different angle. The masseuse in this scene is played by actress model Jan Williams, who appeared mainly in television comedies in England. Let's turn to actor Robert Shaw, who plays Donald Grant with Icy Calm. Although best known for his role as Quint in Jaws and as the Mark in The Sting, Robert Shaw made an equally big splash as a novelist and playwright. In 1959, Shaw published The Hiding Place, which won him acclaim and opened doors for him. Shaw's first love, though, was acting. He grew up in tough circumstance. His father died when he was young. Robert Shaw was only 12. Shaw turned to writing and acting for comfort. Theater provided a surrogate family for Shaw, and he studied at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and joined the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1949. Robert Shaw made a name for himself on British television in much the same way that Sean Connery did, by appearing in short plays adapted for the BBC. Shaw was nominated for an Academy Award for his performance in A Man for All Seasons. He later appeared with Sean Connery in Robin and Marian before his untimely passing at age 50 in 1978. In 1963, Shaw was asked if he preferred acting to writing. He said he preferred the financial comforts of acting and added, quote, let's face it, there are more than 100 published novelists in England who can't get up the price of a decent meal. Italian model and actress Daniela Bianchi faced tough competition for the role of Tatiana Romanova. The producers, eager to repeat their success with Dr. No, wanted to find a new international beauty along the lines of Ursula Andress. At the time, film companies would often publicize the names of actresses auditioning for a role, and publicity agents for rising actresses would also try to link their clients to roles which were not yet cast. As a result, there was a flurry of press attention surrounding the casting of Tatiana Romanova. Journalist Donald Zeck even sat in on auditions in Rome, writing about auditions of actresses such as Yugoslav Silva Cosina, Italian actress Verna Lisi, who was deemed too thin, Annette Stroyberg, who was deemed not thin enough, French actress Helene Chanel, and Eleonora Ruffo. Eventually, the producers announced three finalists, Elga Anderson from Austria, Maria Zinia from Greece, and Daniela Bianchi, the former runner-up in the Miss Universe competition. Reportedly, Sean Connery made the final choice from the three. Sit down. Bianchi had been a successful model in Rome and had done only a few Italian films before From Russia with Love. Although she worked hard on her English skills, she, like many of the performers in the early Bond films, was revoiced. Actress Barbara Jefford did the honors, capturing a perfect blend of Eastern European mystery and sexuality for the character.
I was in love. And if you are not in love?
Let's return to editor Peter Hunt, who talks about the transition from Dr. No to From Russia with Love.
Sensible answer. This man, for instance.
Of course, on From Russia with Love, we had a longer time. I was writing at the beginning. I mean, you know, once they got a script and I was all around and talking with people, Terence particularly. It's a good novel, really. It's full of Fleming's snobbery, which people loved in those days. It's full of the right way to live and the right way to behave and the right clothes to wear and the right food to eat and the right wines to drink. And all of that class stuff, which obviously, you know, was delightful to have after a number of years of war and rationing and all the problems that we had to have during our daily life of that Second World War. Fleming wrote for the reader. He didn't write visually, as it were, although his descriptions of the places were pretty good. Transposing any book from, you know, the book form to a script, to a shootable script, not easy. Very few books transpose, in fact, easily. Some of them do it better than others, and Maybaum was a very good converter of this type of work. And, of course, Richard Maybaum had written a number of Broadway plays, too. A number of very successful. He was one of the younger writers, as it were, still left in Hollywood, you know. And he had an enormous talent and ability for transposing things and for writing scripts and making films work. He was like all of them, like Ben Hecht and all those wonderful old writers, you know, that turned out those wonderful films in the 40s. They really did have a wonderful idea, knack, a way of working and turning out those films, romantic films, and writing dialogue and writing situations.
James Bond here. Over.
He's been asking for you all morning.
Sean carried on the same character, but by then I think Sean knew what he was doing, you know. It became a lot better. But remember, it was the second one. Many of these series of films just collapsed after the second one because the second film was nowhere near. Look at all the remakes they make. They're never as good as the first.
Now to Lois Maxwell, who achieved fame as Miss Moneypenny.
Now, this is the part that I didn't fancy myself playing. Isn't she lovely?
Sounds interesting, James. Lois Maxwell talks about her early career.
This particular part that Eunice played, it was so clever of Terence because they end up together and she's in the beginning of From Russia with Love. I was a soldier, a Canadian soldier, when I was 16. And I came to England just before Christmas of 1943. And it was a dreadful time. I had a wonderful teacher, and he encouraged me enormously. And I, you know, won verse speaking contests and things like that. And in actual fact, I was recruited by the Canadian Army to join the Army show as the gag girl for Wayne and Schuster, the famous Canadian comedians. And they were in the Army show. And Robert Fawn and the famous composer and musician, he was in charge of our orchestra. It was a large orchestra. We traveled by train for 9 months all over Canada. In fact, we even played in Detroit, and we played in Quebec for the famous Quebec Conference. I was then, with my group, brought to England, and I was here for, about a year and a half, I suppose, when the headquarters, my unit was being sent to Italy, and somehow headquarters found out that I was not yet 18, and I should have been about 22. So they decided to send me back to Canada, and they sent me to this sort of holding hospital for Canadian women. And I asked for a weekend leave, and I went to London to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and I told Sir Kenneth Barnes there that I didn't want to go back to Canada. I wanted to stay and go to the Academy. And so he said, well, come the following Wednesday and have an audition. And that meant that I had to go AWOL from the Army. That means absent without leave from the Army, which put me in a very difficult situation. However, I did that, went back the following Wednesday. I had auditioned for him personally when I first met him. And there was a skit I used to do in the Army show, and it was called The Bearded Lady. And I had a long, crinkly, false red beard, and I'd sing, I love the bearded lady because her whiskers tickle so. Her whiskers make me tickle from my head down to my toe. And all this was with a sort of dance, you know. And so at the audition, which was in the theater at RADA, I did a very serious piece and a poem and then a comedy piece. And then I was just about to walk off stage when out of the darkness came Sir Kenneth's voice. And he said, I say, my dear, would you mind doing the bearded lady? So I did the bearded lady again. And I heard shrieks of laughter. And went off and sat in the office near his office. And after about an hour, he came in and said, I am very pleased to tell you, my dear, that you are the first winner of the Lady Louis Mountbatten Scholarship at RADA. So that evening, as I was progressing euphorically up Oxford Street to my bed sitting room, the military police picked me up. And I was in dreadful trouble. So I asked them if I could call Sir Kenneth Barnes. And I called him and I said, I'm not going to be able to take the scholarship because I've been arrested and they're going to send me back to Canada. And I don't know to this day what he did. But I suspect that he instantly got in touch with Lord and Lady Mountbatten's headquarters and told them what had happened, because it was 24 hours later that I was discharged from the Canadian Army.
One of the reasons Bond's relationship with Miss Moneypenny works so well is the uncommon sense of playfulness the actors give the characters. There is sexual tension between the pair, but not romantic longing. Terence Young and Lois Maxwell avoided all the clichés of the lovesick secretary with glasses on, her hair in a bun, and a pencil stuck behind her ear, and the result makes the scenes between Bond and Moneypenny ones that fans look forward to in each 007 adventure. A bit of trivia. The hands which were writing on the photo, belonged to director Terence Young. Now James Bond is off to Istanbul. Here Terence Young attempts to create echoes of Dr. No with Bond's arrival in the enemy's territory. We see the exact same order of shots from Dr. No, the plane landing, the tower announcing the arrival, and a reverse tracking shot of Bond in the airport terminal. Other details are copied as well. Bond is met by a chauffeur, watched by a mysterious figure, and eventually observed by another man in a car in the airport parking lot. But Terence Young switches things around. In this film, the chauffeur is a good guy, the son of Bond's ally, Karen Bay. In Dr. No, the chauffeur was the enemy. The man watching Bond from the car in Dr. No was Quarrel, who helps Bond infiltrate Dr. No's headquarters. In this case, it is Spectre Agent Donald Grant. Even the figure lurking in the background at the airport has switched from CIA agent Felix Leiter to a Bulgar working for the Soviets here. Istanbul proved to be a tough location for the film crew. Two major sequences set to film in Istanbul were eventually shot back in England. But most of the members of the crew also have fond memories of the city.
Oh, yes, sir. Today it's Citroen H3.
Walter Gotell, who was brought to Istanbul to shoot the film's climactic boat chase, recalls the extent of his visit.
It's very friendly.
We went to Turkey to shoot locations. It was a lovely time to go, April. And we settled down, and I found myself taking a house in Yeşilköy, which is on the European side of Istanbul. And we were going to be there for about 6 weeks. And after about 3 or 4 days, Cubby said, "Sorry, we're wrapping. We are not staying here. We're going to the northwest of Scotland." What we found, what he found, what everyone else found, was one, that the helicopters found it very difficult to take off. And the speedboats just wouldn't go fast enough. And if speedboats don't go fast enough, you cannot undercrank, as it's called, which is to speed the film up, because you cannot, with water, speed a film up. So we packed in Istanbul.
Welcome to Istanbul.
Now we meet Karen Bay, a favorite character from both the novel and the film. Terence Young recalls Mexican actor Pedro Armendariz, who played Karen Bay.
Armendariz was a natural. He played the Turkish military intelligence representative. And I have to tell you en passant that he's one of the great men of my life. I mean, I think it's one of the most tragic things that ever happened, his death. And he is a real man in every sense of the word. It was during this picture that he learned that he was going to die. And he came to me and he said, "Look, amigo, I would like this to be my last picture. I would like to have completed this picture. Don't replace me." Because we were going to get another actor to take his part. And even John Ford, he telephoned John Ford, and John Ford telephoned me and said, "Jack," said, "for Christ's sake, help him." So I said, "Of course I intend to, in any case. We're going to shoot round him for the rest of the picture, and we're going to shoot all his scenes first," which we managed to do. And the doctors gave me 3 weeks to complete all his scenes. And it was one of those miracles. We were shooting the gypsy camp sequence, and I'd finished the last scene with Armendariz, and he was walking around shaking hands with everybody. He was limping very badly at that time. In fact, if you notice, he limps not in the long shots. I had a double in the long shots because he couldn't even walk that far. But even in the close shots, when he moved a little bit, he limped with great pain. But he was a man in every sense. And amigo, he was walking around the cast and crew, shaking hands with everybody. He got in his car, and I said, "All right, put the camera here for the next setup." And the rain started to fall, and it rained for 5 days. Mm. If I hadn't had that night without rain, we'd never have finished with Armendariz. He was a marvelous man, a dear, dear man. I love him.
Pedro Armendariz's son, Pedro Armendariz Jr., appeared in 1989's James Bond film License to Kill as Hector Lopez, the president of the fictional nation, Isthmus. For 3 decades, Pedro Armendariz's warm smile and strong masculine screen presence made him a favorite with many top international filmmakers. His last and personally heroic performance in From Russia with Love would prove to be a wonderful testament to his career as an actor. Armendariz was born in Mexico, educated in the United States, where his family moved after the Mexican Revolution. He returned to Mexico after the 1933 declaration of amnesty and worked for the Mexican Railroad and other jobs before turning to acting in local theater productions. Soon he became Mexico's best-known leading man and a favorite of temperamental actor-director Emilio Fernandez. His acclaimed performance in Maria Candelaria helped propel Fernandez's film to win the Palme d'Or at the first Cannes Film Festival in 1946. Armendariz worked with such great directors as John Ford and Louis Buñuel, lighting up the screen with his broad, generous grin and twinkling eyes. He even starred opposite Roger Moore in the Lana Turner period film Dion, about the life and loves of Dion Portia. A bit of obscure trivia. Part of Dion's story is set at the Chateau Denet, which was built for her by the King of France. The real Chateau Denet would feature as a location in the James Bond film Thunderball. Now back to Istanbul and the trials of shooting a complicated film on location. Special effects supervisor John Steers recalls his attempt, along with Joe Fitt and Frank George, to get a crashed helicopter as a prop.
There were quite a few things that happened on From Russia With Love. As you probably were, we went to Istanbul. One of the things I can remember, we wanted a helicopter because, as you're aware, the helicopter crashes. And we did attempt to do some of that stuff in Istanbul. But Harry told us, that's Joe Fitt, Frank and myself, that he had made arrangements with the Turkish Air Force to go to an airfield and bring a helicopter, a crashed helicopter back that we could burn and make it look like it was the one we were using. So, duly armed with a truck and cutting equipment and stuff like that, off we went to this Air Force base. We got straight through the gate, the guard. That was no problem. Mentioned Harry's name, because they didn't know who Harry was. Didn't understand us, I guess. And eventually we came to where the wrecked helicopters were. And we got out, and we said, okay, fine. So we backed the truck up, and then we started to dismantle this thing and put it in the back of the truck. And the next thing, Joe said, I think we've got a problem. So I looked around, and there was about 40 guys standing around us with guns pointing at us. So I said, uh-oh, we've got a big problem here. So we were frog-marched off into a guard room, and then we, from the guard room, were taken to a, well, I suppose it was the camp commander's office, and we sat in chairs in front of him. And I can see it now. There he is sitting there with a big eagle behind him and a Turkish flag and an American flag. And we were asked through an interpreter what we were doing. And I said, well, we came to pick up a helicopter. We were told by Harry Saltzman we could come and take a broken helicopter for our filming. So I said, who is Mr. Harry Saltzman? So I said, oh, my God, now we've got a big problem. So we explained what best we could, and we were getting nowhere fast. I could see we were in trouble this time. And then this the commander said something to this guy, and he went out the room. And the other guys went out the room. And this guy hadn't said a word to us in English before. And he said, I think I can understand the problem here, gentlemen. And he spoke perfect English. I mean, we've been interrogated for about 2 hours before this, and then he suddenly starts speaking perfect English. And he said, I can understand the your problem, he said, but there's a lot of paperwork goes on here, he said, and I think the paperwork didn't get through for Mr. Saltzman. Actually, he said, you were obviously trespassing, he said, and you were stealing American property because the helicopter's American, and we have no right to give them to anybody anyhow because they have to be destroyed. And but he said, you're very lucky, he said, because he said, had I not been here, he said, you might have spent quite a few weeks in jail. So that was a close call.
I had visitors. Limpet mine on the wall outside. Time to catch me at my desk. But by good fortune...
Composer John Barry traveled to Istanbul under the theory that he should listen to the local music. He visited the city with the head of United Artists Music in London, Noel Rogers, and Barry remembers the odd experiences the pair had.
Istanbul was one of the strangest towns. I mean, it was then. We're talking about 30 years ago, I guess, you know. And it was like no place I'd ever been in my life. I mean, I'd been in the army, I'd been travelled around a lot, and it was supposedly to seep up, you know, the music. So Noel Rogers and I, we used to go around these nightclubs in Istanbul and listen to all this stuff, you know. Talk about culture shock. Really came away with absolutely nothing except a lot of ridiculous stories, and then went back, talked to Lyle, and then he wrote Russia with Love, and that was it. We used hardly anything out of that trip at all. I mean, it was really, as far as the music was concerned, was no real use to the dramatic feeling of a James Bond movie. We went to this. It was like a barn, and we were told this gentleman that was appearing that night was like the biggest, the hottest star in Istanbul. So we went along to this, and the audience was such a mixture. You get people in evening dress. It was like a theatre restaurant. It was all tables with booths and chairs. The whole hall was this, and then there would be at one table people in evening dress, and at another table farmers, you know, shepherds just come off the fields, you know. And this is a really weird place. And this guy came out with this big Turkish band doing all this, and he's singing all these songs. Then he went off. Then he came back on and changed. He'd now just got his trousers on and a silk shirt. And as he went through the whole act, finally he came on. There's a woman, and I'm looking at, no, I've never seen an act like this, have you? And they were going crazy. They were going more, this audience were going out of their minds. By the time he came on, this big pink dress at the end, they were going nuts. And we were just like, this is out of Kafka, this thing. I mean, what is this? And we walked out into the streets bewildered, absolutely bewildered. I've never been to an event like that. Either before or since. I mean, it was totally unique. And he was like the young Elvis Presley of Turkey at that particular time. Amazing.
Girl Romana ever come to this room?
Sometimes, with messages.
We were told to go to this bar. They said, oh, it's great, and have great music there. And we went along, I think it was about 7:30 at night. And we were sat there until about 9:30, 10. And we were still the only people in this place. And it was a huge old building with this huge old oak bar with this big brass rail screwed into the bar. And Noel and I said, well, when's this place liven up? And the guy behind the bar couldn't speak a word of English. And finally, I said, you know, let's get out of here. Nothing is happening. We've been here for 2 hours. And I leant on this rail, and the whole thing went. It collapsed. The whole length of the bar. It was about, when I say 50 foot, I'm not kidding, it was like this huge hall. And this bar, this rail had been there probably 30, 40 years. The whole thing went on the floor. And there's about three guys came out and kind of looked at us and at the bar. And I just said to Noel, let's go. So he said, night, thank you very much. And we turned up, got out of the door, and they didn't come after us. It was just so bizarre. If you put that in a movie, people would say, come on. It was like this, as I say, this Kafka bar. We were quite happy when we got on the plane to fly back to London, I got to tell you.
I see now why you keep the Rolls.
One of my sons is driving it, with two dummies in the back, in the opposite direction. They'll follow it for hours. You like my gypsy friends. I use them like the Russians use the Bulgars. I'm afraid it's created a blood feud between them.
Actor Pedro Armendariz was gravely ill with cancer while filming From Russia with Love and died before completion of the film. In shots like these, a double was used instead of Armendariz. But Armendariz worked diligently to complete as many shots as he possibly could in the film. And he even arranged to re-record his dialogue before he left to go back to Los Angeles, where he passed away.
Pedro.
We are in the Gypsy Camp, which was slated to be filmed in Turkey, near the Topkapi section of Istanbul. But it was actually shot on the back lot of Pinewood Studios, as Terence Young recalls.
I think we'll be allowed to stay.
It worked awfully well, and strangely enough, we had found a place like that. I shot that eventually in the studios in England. It was too cold, but I reconstructed completely an area like that above Top Gappy, where the gypsies do hang out. We auditioned a whole lot of girls. In fact, we practically had eliminating contests. We started with about 8 girls in training, and then we ended up with these 2 because they were the best. They were the wildest looking. Mm-hmm. And both of them had a very, very strongly gypsy look about them. Martine Beswick is half Jamaican, is Alicia Gore is Israeli, and let's put it this way, they didn't look like white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, let's put it that. We had them training for about 3 or 4 weeks, and you need to do that.
While we watch Lilo perform, let's spend some time with Alicia Gurr, who, like Martine Beswick, achieved a certain level of fame as one of the gypsy fighting women.
Originally, the set was scheduled, and I think partially built and also located in Istanbul, Turkey. Harry Saltzman and Cabby Barkley decided that let's build a set in Pinewood and let's shoot it all in Pinewood.
Alicia Gurr recalls working with stunt arranger Peter Perkins on choreographing the fight.
Peter took Martine Beswick and myself on 3 weeks training. We came to Pinewood Studio every day and rehearsed. Interestingly enough, my mother was a prima ballerina at the Paris Opera House, and Peter knew and admired her work. And she came over while we were doing From Russia with Love, which, according to Peter, made his days. That fight, which lasted on screen less than 2.5 minutes, got me more publicity till today and more fan mail than any leading role I ever had. There is a big cult of fans, and now I'm really glad that I listened to Peter, but once we filmed it, it was rough. And Martine was terrific to work with. She was just terrific. Martine is originally from Jamaica, and when I met her, she felt that I was a baby. I was 17. She figured that she'll protect me. She advised me on hair, on makeup, on what to do with my hair. She advised me on men, whom to talk to, whom not to talk to. And as she said, once my mother arrived, she felt like she didn't have to chaperone me anymore, but she sure was a great girl.
Now we hear from Alicia Gurr's combatant, Jamaican actress Martine Beswick.
So we're supposed to go to Turkey. And we had everything ready. We had the visas, we had the passports, everything was ready. And at the last minute, they said, oh, no, we're going to shoot it on the back lot. We were so disappointed. And then everybody, they shot the scene. We spent about a week there on the back lot. It sort of put me on the map, I suppose, really. It started my career. I mean, then I got kind of serious about it, and I realized that I had to go and take some training. And as a matter of fact, Sean was very, very terrific, because my voice was like in here. And he said, oh, I think you should go and see Cecily Berry. You've got to go and see her. She'll tell you how to, you know, bring your voice up. And I went, oh, thanks, Sean. You know, so off I went. And she was great. He sort of put me in touch with this wonderful woman who changed my voice, completely changed my voice and my whole sort of instrument and my acting. And she was very, very good. So he was responsible for that, actually. And also, Terrence said, now, go and get some experience, darling. Go and get some experience. So I did. I loved Terrence. I really did. He was just great. I mean, he always took charge and completely took care of us. And I loved that about him. I really did. I loved that about him. He was terribly grand. And I really enjoyed being around him for that reason.
As the fight ends, an enormous battle erupts. Terrence Young does 2 things with this scene. First, he creates a real sense of chaos in the proceedings. The battle is messy, loud. The gunfire comes from all directions. But then Terrence Young makes a brilliant choice. Bond does fight, but he moves around the battle, attacking as he sees fit, rolling a burning wagon into 2 grappling men, firing an occasional shot. knocking out the unsuspecting enemy agent. What this shows us is Bond moving above the chaos, never getting drawn into the mire. It is a point Terrence Young makes in all of his Bond films. 007 goes for the big targets. In Dr. No, Bond rips up the girl's photographer's film, but he doesn't even bother to have her arrested, even though she is obviously in league with the villain. In Thunderball, Bond sends an assassin to report back to Spectre agent Emilio Largo. He tells the man, "The little fish I throw back into the sea." Here Bond acts in much the same way. It is not his fight. He just helps settle it. Now John Barry talks about this piece of music, the 007 theme.
That was a product of leaning slightly more to the sense of fun that the Bond movies, after Dr. No and then from Russia with Love, there was a sense adventure was fun. And so I wanted to write an adventure theme that had an up feeling about it. Because the audience caught on so quick, even when they went into From Russia with Love, they knew they were in for a good time. The style had been set in Dr. No. And the audience are very quick. The audience is sometimes ahead of the game. And so I wanted a lighter, adventuresome sound in the adventure theme, that so the audience could sit and relax. I think it relaxed the audience. They started to have fun with the adventure, and they knew he was going to come out at the end of it. So it was just a little more tongue-in-cheek in terms of the theme than the original, and we used it on throughout a lot of the Bond movies that came in. And it was a lighter, more airy, uplifting kind of a theme. And that was the thought behind that. It's a very military kind of... The Secret Service was a very kind of military operation. So that's where the military thing came from, plus my own experience in the military. And it had a great driving sense, too. And then I just wrote this big, big 16-bar open melody, which was like a feel-good adventure theme with the trumpets and horns, that staccato accompaniment, and that's how it came out.
Robert, I thank you for saving his life. You are now his
director
son.
Terrence Young discusses John Barry's contribution.
I'd like to ask him a favor.
When we did From Russia with Love, we brought in another composer to write the theme song From Russia with Love. But John Barry, that was his first dramatic score for a whole picture. And the rest is history. John is now one of the most famous musicians in the business. He is incredibly professional, has got a tremendous smell for the type of music. I mean, at various times, I've wanted something different. And he said, "Will you let me try it this way? And then if you don't like it, I'll do what you want." And with one or two exceptions, I've always been able to say, "Look, I'm completely wrong and you're completely right. John, let's use the other." Sometimes I've said, "No, I want to change it." And he goes straight away because he knows that I'm not doing it for any ego trip or anything like that. I think music is enormously important. I had one of the most successful films ever made, which had certainly one of the most successful musical scores of all time. It was a film called The Warsaw Concerto, which was made during the war. And I don't think there's a place in the world that hasn't heard that goddamn bit of music, you know. But John is a very gifted film musician, in my opinion, one of the best film musicians. He has a feeling for celluloid. He knows sometimes where film should be and where it should not, where music should be and where it should not be, you know. I think he's a very, very gifted person. I think it's one of his very best scores. His music, it's a funny thing. Very often, somebody who writes... important scoring that the music is very heavy and all that, very often it can be distracting. But in John's cases, I'd have said nearly always they are helpful, they add to the mood, they add to the excitement of a sequence. They certainly did in the one that you just talked about. I mean, the gypsy sequence and all that battle, which was enormously effective. It was a long stretch of music running about 8 minutes altogether. Very, very effective.
Production designer Sid Kane created the sets for From Russia with Love. He had worked as Ken Adams' art director on Dr. No. Here he tells a wonderful story about Harry Saltzman in Istanbul.
We were filming out in Turkey, staying in the Hilton Hotel. And in the evening, I used to go down below and look at the shops because I'm a teetotaler, I don't drink. And there's this sort of jeweler's shop underneath the Hilton. And I was down there one evening looking for a present for my wife, and a voice said, "What are you doing?" said, and it was Harry. And I said, "I'm looking for a present for my wife, Harry." He said, "Well, do you want to go up this end?" Now, in this shop, there was a long glass showcase with jewellery in, period, and things. And I was down this end, which was the cheap end, and it went up in price as you went along. Harry said, "You want to?" He said, "This is what you want." I said, "Harry, that's your end." I said, "I'm looking." But I was getting about £55 a week then, you see. Anyway, he came and he bought a ring. And he said, "Look, why don't you buy that?" And it was a beautiful ring. It was what they call a harem ring. And it was gold and enamel with rubies. So I said, "Harry, you know, I could never buy that for my wife." Anyway, cut a long story short, I go back to my room eventually, and there's this ring by my bed, you see, and I felt terribly embarrassed. And the following morning, I said to Stanley Sopel, who was the managing fellow at the time, I said, "Stanley, I'm terribly embarrassed. I want to see Harry. He's embarrassed me no end." So I go and see Harry, and he said, I've embarrassed you." I said, "You have, Harry." I said, "No way." I said, "It's very, very kind of you to put this ring there." I said, "But my wife would know immediately I couldn't afford that anyway." So he said, "I'll tell you what we'll do." He said, "You give it to your wife from me for allowing you to come on location." And he said, "Bring her out for a fortnight on the firm." And that was Harry, because she still got the rings. Beautiful. No, Harry was very generous. I liked him, really.
This scene, where Bond eventually meets Tatiana Romanova in his bed, is very similar to Fleming's novel. Even much of the dialogue is unchanged. But production designer Sid Kane,
Hello?
Director of photography Ted Moore, and director Terrence Young helped create a mood of seduction here by the use of gauzy curtains, soft lighting, rich, cool colors, and a palpable sexual tension between the actors. This theme of a female spy sent to seduce a man has been touched on since the biblical writings about Samson, the Old Testament hero and Israelite judge who battled the Philistines. Unfortunately, Samson was seduced by a Philistine woman, Delilah, who discovered the secret of his strength, cut his hair while he slept, and reduced him to a blind slave before he found vengeance and salvation. In World War I, Mata Hari was famed for seducing men of power and selling their secrets, costing lives on the battlefield. Alfred Hitchcock explored the inner life of the female spy who is asked to seduce the enemy. He came up with a classic tale of soul erosion and salvation in Notorious, where a loose woman, played by Ingrid Bergman, seduces and marries a Nazi agent to pay for her father's sins. In From Russia with Love, Fleming and the filmmakers offer a nice twist. The seductress herself gets seduced. Fleming plays with the sexuality of the task and the fantasy of strangers meeting who already know they are scripted by their various governments to sleep together. Neither Fleming nor the filmmakers allow Tatiana, or Tanya as she likes to be called, to be in on the full scope of the plot, and thus she is not linked to the villains. She is an innocent, working under penalty of death. From the very beginning, when we see Colonel Klebb with Tatiana, the audience understands that James Bond has nothing to fear from her. She is just a pawn, and indeed, she serves the same structural purpose as the Lecter decoder. Bond must bring her back to the West for there to be a satisfactory conclusion to the story. In emotional terms, Tanya is far more important than the Lecter. She is the maiden who is tormented by Rosa Klebb's fiery-haired dragon. Bond must do more than bed her. He must win her over. Let's return to James Bond's creator, Ian Fleming, who visited the location in Istanbul. By all accounts, Fleming had a wonderful trip and enjoyed spending time with the members of the cast and crew. One person he got to know was producer Covey Broccoli's wife. Dana Broccoli recalls spending time with Ian Fleming in Istanbul and a memorable dinner with Harry Saltzman on his last night in the city.
Ian was there during the filming, and we were both great sightseers, so we went everywhere, into the markets and into the mosques and up and down the Bosphorus. We just had a great time. It was Ian's last night in Istanbul, and he was very tired, and he really wanted to stay in the hotel with us and have dinner. But we were giving this company dinner at a restaurant just outside of the hotel, and we talked Ian into coming along. And he said, well, I hope it's a quiet place. And we said, well, I'm sure it will be. When we got there, there were belly dancers all over the place, and there was a German wedding going on at the next table. And Harry, who had this wonderful thing of ordering food for everybody, and if he didn't like what he got, everybody's order went back. So Ian was in the middle of this, and food was coming in from every angle. And he held his head, and he said, Covey, I don't want any of this food. I'm tired, and this is noisy. And it's so Covey said, well, that's all right, Ian. What would you like? What would you like to eat? He said, I want a Spanish omelet. And Covey said, well, I'll see if I can arrange that. And he took the next half hour trying to describe a Spanish omelet to the poor waiter.
We are now approaching the most interesting corner of St. Sophia, including these two great red porphyry columns stolen and brought from...
Editor Peter Hunt's skills are quite evident in this scene. Peter Hunt worked with the first three actors to play James Bond. He edited the first five Bond films and was second unit director on You Only Live Twice. He then directed George Lazenby's sole Bond film, On Her Majesty's Secret Service. After On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Hunt went on to direct Roger Moore in the television series The Persuaders, and then in Gold and Shout at the Devil, two films he made in the 1970s. He directed two films with actor Lee Marvin, Shout at the Devil and Death Hunt. He worked with Terrence Young again on The Jigsaw Man in the mid-1980s, and then returned to editing with the Michael Cimino thriller, Desperate Hours.
As the St. Sophia wishing column, tens of thousands...
Editor Peter Hunt talks about the elements which make this sequence a success.
The sound was the sound of the mosque. You know, that whole commentary which of the guide who was going round behind the whole scene, moving around. That was actual. It was real. John Mitchell was the sound man, and he shot it in the mosque like that. And it really was wonderful. Of course, what contributed greatly to it was the music. John Barry's music behind that was remarkable and worked so well. Wonderful instance of what a musician, what a film musician can do for a scene.
Legendary composer John Barry had been a band leader for a number of years with the influential group the John Barry Seven. From Russia with Love was one of his early film scores. Here, he discusses how he shaped the music for the film.
The actual content of the music was not based on the Turkish scale, that chromatic scale thing. It was based on Western musical structure, if you like. And it was purely the instrumentation that gave it the slightly exotic kind of feel of Istanbul, finger cymbals and cymbalums and things like that. It was really like salt and pepper, you know. It was really like the dressing. It was like the condiments of the orchestra. The orchestra was a full-blooded, traditional English symphony orchestra, if you like, with these colours added to it that gave it that Turkish feeling. But it really was no more than that.
Norman Wanstall helped create the other end of the spectrum of sounds heard in From Russia with Love. Although sound is recorded on location, Wanstall was responsible for replacing most location sounds with sound effects. He talks about the difference between working on From Russia with Love and Dr. No.
The great thing about moving on to Russia with Love was that I wasn't questioned so often, because recording theatres are very, very expensive. And people were saying to me, look, we don't have the money on this film. This is Dr. No. You're going in there and spending all this time creating all these wonderful sounds. We don't have the money. So, you know, can you call it? Can you stop doing it? And I found that very frustrating, because I knew that this was the best way of approaching the picture, was to get important sounds created early on. As we moved on to Rush with Love, I got the feeling that we had established ourselves, we'd made our reputations, we were trusted, that we weren't wasting money, we were in for the movie, and that we were trying to make Bond films as dramatic as we possibly could. And I went on to Russia feeling a lot more confident that I wasn't going to be questioned as to whether or not we had to watch The Pennies. It wasn't a big budget picture, but I don't seem to remember on Russia that I had so many times when I felt I wanted to go and spend people's money. What did happen with the films was that you could go to the production manager and ask for the most outrageous facilities, and they never questioned it.
All of this material in Istanbul comes from the fertile imagination of the James Bond filmmaking team. In Fleming's novel, Bond sleeps with Tatiana, then the pair leave the next morning on the Orient Express. Here the filmmakers have Bond and Tatiana together, then separate them. They only meet furtively in public places, which serves two purposes. First, the audience wants these characters together, and creating obstacles to that end makes the audience even more eager. Second, in Fleming's novel, Tatiana decides she wants to defect with Bond from the outset. The suspense is based on whether she will succeed. Richard Maybaum creates more suspense by having Karen Bay constantly question Tatiana's true motivation, and Tatiana herself is torn between her fear of Kleb and her interest in Bond. This dramatic separation presents an opportunity to the filmmakers to utilize the scenic locations in Istanbul by creating sequences in the San Sofia Mosque, this scene on the Bosphorus ferry, and the stealing of the Lector decoder from within the bowels of the Russian embassy. Each of these new scenes allows the opportunity for the filmmakers not only to create suspense and dramatic tension, but also to give the audience a look at the more exotic parts of Istanbul. Director Terence Young has also taken great care to make certain that Sean Connery looks just as attractive as any other element in the film. Connery was outfitted for the film with 8 suits, 2 top coats, and a full evening suit for the opening sequence, all tailored by Anthony Sinclair of Savile Row. In 1963, these hand-tailored items cost over $2,000. Connery's bespoke tailored shirts were produced by Turnbull and Asser at a cost of $30 each. At the time of this recording, the assortment of Savile Row suits would cost over $20,000, and the shirts, $200 apiece. Such is the price of elegance. James Bond is now about to steal the Lector decoder from the Soviet embassy. It is interesting that in the novel, Bond is not required to do anything to get the decoder. Tanya delivers it to him. The filmmakers return to the St. George versus the Dragon template so that Bond rescues Tanya. The pair escape through the tunnels beneath Istanbul, which gave the filmmakers a chance to recreate one of the most vivid moments from Fleming's novel. In Chapter 16 of the novel From Russia with Love, Karen Bay shows Bond how he uses the tunnels of the city's 80 underground cisterns to reach a point beneath the Russian embassy, where Karim has a periscope installed. The scene is recreated in the film, but the element which makes the reader's skin crawl, the horde of rats, is saved for Bond and Tanya's escape with the Lector. In the novel, as Bond and Karim approach the Russian embassy, they force thousands of rats to recede up the tunnel ahead. And then, when they reach the alcove beneath the embassy, they watch the rats swarm back down the tunnel by the thousands. It is one of Ian Fleming's more vivid passages. The filmmakers use the explosion beneath the embassy as the motivation for the rats to swarm in the movie, but creating the effect proved more complicated than the filmmakers could have possibly imagined, as Sid Kane remembers.
We weren't allowed to use real wild rats in England, so naturally I got white rats, and we covered them in cocoa, darkened them down with cocoa. But the heat of the lamps made them sort of very lethargic, and they just used to sit and lick this cocoa off. So we had sort of brown and white rats, which wasn't quite the thing. And so I went to Spain and found a warehouse, and we were allowed out there to use real rats from the sewage. All horrible things, all moth-eaten, huge things. And so I built a glass cage for the camera crew, obviously, to hide to be behind, and the rat catchers, and we blocked as many holes as we could, you know, stop them escaping. And I built the set in the warehouse. The rat catcher let about 200 rats freeze there, and they came sort of pouring around. That was all right for take one. Then they wanted to take two. Well, we got our shot, and then they all escaped. It was mayhem, I can't tell you. Cubby was the first one up the steps. He's up some steps first. He beat me by a short head. And we were hanging on to everything to get rid of these bloody great rats chasing us all over the place. So that was quite an exciting sequence, actually.
Even catching the rats proved to be an adventure. First, Sid Kane offered a London dock worker 10 shillings for each rat he could catch. Soon, British health authorities stepped in and confiscated the wild rats. As Sid Kane relates, the white rats proved unworkable, and the filmmakers decided to shoot the scene in Spain. They hired one Pedro Vidal to supply the rats. Mr. Vidal went to the Madrid sanitation department, as he related in press interviews during the film's release. Sanitation workers placed a number of 15-gallon wine casks in the Madrid sewers. They would bait the casks, and each morning, huge sewer rats would be found inside, unable to climb up the slick glass walls. Publicity materials created for the film bragged that the rats were, quote, ferocious and disease-ridden, and sometimes they were growing as large as house cats. Eventually, more than 500 wild rats were captured. In 1963, Vidal talked about his task. He said, quote, I have never done a job I hated more. Rats give me the creeps, unquote. One of the big problems in Istanbul can be seen in this shot, the huge crowds on the streets. Terence Young talks about the challenge of shooting when the film crew becomes a tourist attraction.
He was shooting in the main square there, and we had 12,000 people. There were 400 policemen, including 60 men on horses, trying to control the crowds. And the only way we were able to shoot to get them far enough away from the camera was we faked another sequence with two stuntmen climbing out of an eight-story window on a rope while they were being filmed by a camera with lights. And while everybody went and watched them, we got on with our picture.
If you're quick, you can catch a glimpse of Harry Saltzman's wife, Jackie, in the window just in front of Robert Shaw. We are now aboard the Orient Express, one of the great trains of Europe. In its heyday, the Orient Express traveled 1,400 miles from Istanbul to Belgrade, Yugoslavia, Venice, Milan, Lausanne, and Paris. The train has been immortalized by Graham Greene in his 1932 novel, Orient Express, and by Agatha Christie in her 1934 classic mystery, Murder on the Calais Coach, which was later renamed Murder on the Orient Express. Interestingly, Sean Connery also starred in the film version of the Agatha Christie novel. The Orient Express itself connected Paris and Istanbul from 1883 to 1977, when the line was closed due to declining business. Eventually, the old coaches were restored and refitted, and the trains were reintroduced as the Venice-Simplon Orient Express and opened to the tourist trade as a first-class European rail travel adventure with formal black-tie dinners and service from London or Paris to Venice. These interiors were recreated on sound stages at Pinewood Studios by Sid Kane. Kane recalls going to France to examine the train itself.
I went to France to copy the inside of the real thing. And I was drawing away and measuring and so forth. And the bloody train started to move off, and I was in it. And I had to go miles up the track before I could get back again. That's how we did it. I thought it looked quite good, actually, the train. I was quite pleased with it in the end. And the original one was a bit tatty for filming, you know. So, I repainted it slightly better. Touched it up a bit. Added a bit of glamour.
Sid Kane is one of the great English production designers, although that is a title he never fully embraced. He was in the Air Force during World War II, but his fighter plane crashed in Rhodesia, and Kane suffered a broken back and two broken legs. Kane recovered from those injuries and was then promptly struck by lightning. He was then assigned to ground duty, where he was first introduced to the film industry.
I was in charge of flying control at Tangmere in England in 1944, after my accident and so forth. And a couple of chaps came from the film industry. They wanted to photograph the inside of flying control. They were making a film. And I said, no way can you take a photograph, but I'll do you a quick plan and elevation if you like. I said, can you? I said, yeah. That's what I used to do before the war. So anyway, I knocked out this quick plan and elevation for them, and I got interested in the film business. I didn't realise they had draftsmen, for example, in the film business. And when I gave them this thing, they said, thinking I was going to be in the RAF forever, I suppose, they said, when you come out of the RAF, come and see us, you see. And 2 weeks later, I got my medical discharge. So I thought about this film business thing, and I went to Ealing, and I saw a chap called Hal Mason. And anyway, he gave me a list of studio managers, and one of them happened to be a friend of mine that's from school days, Albert Fennell, who was a big producer. He was, he's dead now, unfortunately. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I got in touch with Albert, and he said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, nothing, really. I'm just looking for work. He said, oh, come and join us. Not asking me what I did. The only thing I could do was draw. So I came into the art department, and that's it, 1944. And from then on, I was draftsman, T-boy, and then I became chief draftsman and assistant art director, and I rose to the dizzy heights of art director eventually, and production designer. That's how it all happened.
Sid Kane went on to work with many of the great directors. He worked with Stanley Kubrick on Lolita, François Truffaut on Fahrenheit 451, and Alfred Hitchcock on Frenzy. When Peter Hunt came to direct on Her Majesty's Secret Service, he chose Sid Kane to do the production design, and then worked with Kane later on the Roger Moore films Gold and Shout at the Devil. Hunt discusses Sid Kane's work.
He was a very good production designer. Total different personality to Ken Adam, of course. Ken Adam is a flamboyant and grand type of production designer. But Sid Kane is a quiet, methodical worker with a very good imagination and a very good concept of the problems, the film problems. He's got a sense of humour to dry with, yes. Production designer means that he designs all the, not only all the sets, but the costumes and the colour, and it incorporates the whole thing. See, in From Russia with Love, the story is the most important thing. You don't have to balance it with a lot of fantastic sets or, you know, incredible production values. It needed very good practical, a train, you know, the nicest part of Istanbul, the nicest part of all the towns that you went along. So you didn't require great big fantastic sets for it.
That would be splendid.
Back to Sid Kane.
To be quite serious, I work in conjunction with the costume designer, and I say, well, obviously, what is she going to wear, etc., etc. I mean, if she says she's going to wear green, I don't do a green background. I mean, any art director can paint the set red, and people see and say, what a lovely set, or did you see that set? And they don't remember who was in it, which I think is wrong. You know, you must design the set to give you an atmosphere for the characters. They come first, and I always say to my friends, did you remember such a set? And they say, oh yeah, it's great. I say, well, what were the colours of the set? And they get embarrassed because they can't remember. I say, well, that's fine. If you don't remember, it's not outstanding. So that's how I arrived at the colours, various colours. And I've got what they call a cold eye. A lot of my colours, funnily enough, are cold. My blues and greens and yellows and things like that. I enjoyed working with Terence. I thought Terence was terrific. I thought actually he was Bond. He's very elegant and had all the Bond characteristics. And I think he sort of put this into the original Bond, to be quite honest. And great to work with, Terence. Always ready to accept any ideas, you know. And because he used to say, if it's a good idea, it's my name on the credits. So I wish I remembered later.
They killed each other.
Yeah, I like Covey. Everybody liked Covey, I guess. When we did Dr. No, I was the art director. I wasn't the production designer. That was Ken Adam. But I was the art director and did locations. And when it came to the credits, dear old, what's his name, left my name off of credits accidentally. And Covey said, well, it's going to cost us a lot of money to change all the credits again. So I said, oh, I don't bother. So he gave me a gold pen, solid gold pen, in lieu of credit. That was Covey. And he's Aries, wasn't he? Same as me, he was Aries. So we got on well.
We are right now in one of the most dramatically interesting points in any James Bond film. Here, note how director Young lets this confrontation unfold on the actors' faces. Young lets the actors play out their emotions. Connery reveals Bond's barely controlled anger in layers, faux patience.
I want the truth.
Bitterness.
James, you're hurting me.
I'll do worse than that if you don't tell me. You're doing this under orders, I know. What are they?
I don't know what you mean.
Liar.
An ultimate explosion of violence. Daniela Bianchi plays Tanya's fear and confusion with conviction. It is a risky scene to let the two leads fight this viciously this late in the film, but the violence, the dread, and the ultimate resignation of Bond that he can neither trust Tanya nor get rid of her makes the scene palpably real. For the viewer, there is a sense of real risk to the relationship between Bond and Tanya that despite the chemistry between the pair, they may not end up together. Director Young handles the dramatics with skill, and the good performances pay off for him, as he has a great visual moment coming up, which acts as punctuation. It is interesting to note that all of what the audience is seeing has been laid out clearly by the filmmakers. At the beginning, Kronstein reveal all to Blofeld and the audience, outlining Spectre's plan step by step. We know exactly who killed the Russian in the mosque, who killed the Bulgar following Bond, and who killed Karen Bay. Terence Young has held nothing back from us, and thus creates the maximum dramatic suspense. The audience knows why everything up until this point has happened. We just don't know what is going to happen next. And now we see Terence Young's chilling punctuation to the previous scene. The cool, calm Donald Grant shadowing Bond. 007's every move is being watched, studied, and virtually choreographed by Grant, who now stalks the real Bond much the same way he stalked the imposter Bond in the film's opening. The visual also serves another purpose. It explains to the audience that the conflict between Bond and Tanya is manufactured by Grant. It reminds the viewer that they are really allies against Spectre. Now to dubbing editor Norman Wanstall, who talks about the sound effects for the Orient Express.
As in practically all train sequences in movies, and the audience very rarely realize it, that invariably it's a built set. A lot of the stuff in Rush with Love was a built set. The soundtracks that we use were from sound effects libraries, and it's quite tricky really to get plenty of variation, because it's very, very easy to become very monotonous when you're doing train sounds. I always remember this was one of the facilities that we had on the dubbing desk. where they could produce aspects of sound that I could never do in the editing room. And the problem you have is that you're traveling in one part of the train, but you move outside the carriage, and you know that the sound would invariably change. So what do? Do you find another soundtrack, exactly the same speed, with the rattle-rattle that sounds different? But what Gordon McCallum was able to do, he said, no, give me the same track all the way through, and make sure I can see cue where we cut to the outside and to the inside, and I will swing in my facilities and we'll change the nature of the sound. And that was a tremendous help to me, because I battled for a long time to think how I could get the difference between the inside and the outside. I don't mean the inside and the outside of the train, I mean the inside of the carriage and the inside of the corridor. And what he did, he just swung in top, or took out the bass as we went across, and produced a constant flow of rattle.
Norman Wanstall's first visit to a film set was during the shooting of Hell Below Zero, which was produced by Cubby Broccoli.
We're going back a lot of years now, but the whole of the film industry in Britain was a studio system, and people joined a studio like you would join any other company. And that's where you would stay. You would have a contract usually for about 3 years. And I knew a lady who was the mother of a very close school friend of mine, and she showed us around the studio for one day. And I was only 14, and we saw pictures of stars all around the walls, and all the girls were dressed very cool with things around their neck. And the whole thing was magic. And we went on a set to, it was the set of Hell Below Zero, but we didn't realize that at the time. And I always remember going into this far stage, which was pitch black. And in the far corner, you could see this very tiny bead of light. We crept towards it, and the nearer you got, you realized that it was actually a complete replica of the interior of a cabin of a ship. And there was no way a lay person would believe that it wasn't a real cabin. But of course, as soon as we crept round the back, it was all full of scaffold poles and timber and plywood. And us kids realized that movie making is just magic, and it's all make-believe. And we were completely and utterly captivated by the whole atmosphere of the place. And when I finished my national service, I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful just to be part of that world, you know, to be in a movie studio and actually take part in some way. And so I contacted this lady, and she remembered me, and she said, well, come and talk, and I'll tell you what the chances are. But I always imagined I was going to be on a set. I always imagined I'd be a cameraman or wear one of these things and sit in a chair with my name on the back. But when they put me into an editing room, I wasn't too sure that's really what I had in mind, because I really didn't know what the editor was doing. Very few people do understand what an editor does. Most people think an editor is someone who just cuts the bad bits out. They don't realize that you have to build a film from scratch, from all the different shots. But as time went on and I realized what we were doing, I became really engrossed and totally overcome by the whole job. And they put me under contract for 3 years. And when the contract was over, I had a chance to go with probably the most famous soundtrack editor we've ever had in this country, a man called Winston Ryder. And he was freelance, whereas everybody else, most people, were permanently employed. And the sort of films he'd worked on was Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai. I mean, the biggest movies were his. And I had a chance to be his assistant on the sound side. So rather than renew the contract, I went with him, and I did 3 films with him. And they were all very large ones. And I learned a lot from him. And I suppose that was really the basis of my knowledge for the future. So when I had a chance to, when I had a break, I had to fall back on all I'd learned from him.
Yes.
And he was a good teacher.
Try to keep in shape.
A few bits of trivia about what we've just seen. The man Grant escorts into the men's room and murders is played by Bill Hill, who is the production manager of From Russia with Love. Sirkeci Station in Istanbul doubles for both Zagreb Station and Sofia Station, and the scenes were shot on May 1st, 1963. It is interesting to note that Robert Shaw's character, Donald Grant, does not speak in the film until he's aboard the Orient Express. Editor Peter Hunt recalls Robert Shaw and building the tension surrounding this meeting.
I knew Robert Shaw when we used to ring him up and bring him down to play opposite actresses for tests and things like that. Robert Shaw and I go back right to the early training days of what was called Group 3 those days. He was a stage man, of course. He was a theatre actor. and great. It was a great piece of casting for From Russia With Love. It really was. He and Lottie Lenya were very good. And I used to coach him with his dialogue on From Russia With Love, only just to listen to him. He needed somebody always to listen to him. And in fact, it was my idea, which happened after we'd shot the scenes, only when I'd seen it and got it together, that we didn't hear his voice and that he spoke at imitating another spy. On the train. You see him talk, and I put lots of train noise over it, so there was a good reason why you never heard it. And the steam came out from underneath the train. So that it meant that the first time you actually heard him was when he got together with Bond. You never heard him in the garden, in the training center, when she whacks him in the stomach. He never says anything.
Peter Hunt discusses his background in the film industry.
I grew up in London, in the East End of London, and I went to what is called an English grammar school at Brentwood. I was always very keen on cinema and what have you. Various members of my family were connected with the theatre in London, and an uncle of mine, who was actually my mother's cousin or second cousin, but we called him an uncle, was in fact a cameraman. At one time he was here in California and was a cameraman with MGM. And he had a laboratory and a documentary company in London, which I used to like to get into when I was on school holidays. And I liked him very much and used to talk to him. And that was really how my professional interest came about. In the cinema. And of course I adored the cinema as a kid anyway. I was never allowed to see as many films as I wanted to see. So when the war came, which was in 1939, 3rd of September 1939, a chaos really reigned in England to a certain extent. Schools were evacuated and kids were shipped away because we all thought we were going to be bombed. I decided I didn't want to go anywhere, and I started to do work with this uncle of mine, who was then contracted to make a number of instructional films, they would call them, instructional films about applying first aid bandages and things to do with the war efforts. And from there, of course, I eventually graduated into the cutting rooms on feature films. I got my first editing job due to two producers who were making a very good film, I thought, a wonderful story. Having been for a number of years an assistant in the cutting room and gone through the whole rigmarole of learning my craft, in the these two producers eventually came. But during the course of the film, of course, they fell out with one another. And through a series of shrewd, cunning, cunning diplomatic moves on my part, I became the editor of the film. And I was able to contain one producer in his capacity of what he wanted on the film, and also the American producer in his capacity and what he wanted on the film. They ended up by not talking to each other, so neither knew what I was doing. They only knew what I was doing for them, which of course made the film end up completely the same for both of them. That's how I got my first break.
Now back to this classic scene. One of the best confrontations between Bond and a villain. For the next 5 minutes, Terence Young sustains the audience's interest with only two characters in a confined space. The scene works because of the groundwork laid since the very opening sequence. The filmmakers have taken care to keep the tension high and the suspense real throughout, and it pays off. Here Bond finally finds out that he has been played as a puppet by Spectre, and just as importantly, that Tanya is not his enemy. In the novel, Grant actually tries to kill Bond with a gun hidden inside a copy of War and Peace. When Grant fires, the bullet hits Bond's gunmetal cigarette case in his breast pocket rather than his heart. Here, Grant has taken away Bond's cigarette case. the filmmakers also replaced Fleming's gun in a book with another gadget developed during World War II.
Of course.
A garrote wire hidden in a watch. The character of Donald Grant is so well realized that he was virtually recreated in the Brian De Palma film Blowout by actor John Lithgow. With a straight face, De Palma has Lithgow dye his hair white, pull on a black glove before killing, and murder his victims with a garrote in his watch. The credit for this goes largely to Terrence Young. His work with the actors and with Richard Maybaum creates a scene filled with every bit of the tension of Fleming's original novel. Yet Young's scene is different. The setting is the same, but the plot is far more complex. The interplay has been carefully reworked from the novel to make the film feel fresh and new. But the success of this part of the film goes beyond any attempt to make the material interesting for Fleming's readers. It goes to the cinematic world of James Bond, which Terrence Young had such a strong hand in creating. Young, working with Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, developed James Bond into a character which reflected the stylish elegance of Fleming's evocative prose. James Bond's style was the key. With Fleming's characters and stories, Terrence Young fleshed out the cinematic 007 with all the human details, from the way he walked, to how he kissed, to how he held a gun. To capture the particularly English elegance of the character, Terrence Young looked to himself as a person who knew style from the inside out. Sound editor Norman Wanstall remembers Terrence Young and how he approached James Bond.
I think a lot of people used to say that Terrence Young really was James Bond. You know, he was like directing himself, because he was the public school gentleman with the blazer, upright and good-looking, and obviously had had a fairly affluent past.
That's only half of it, old man.
The image of James Bond, as in the book, seemed to fit Terrence. And he was fairly cavalier, too. He didn't seem to get uptight, simple as that.
From her.
I thought he was very right for the part, as they say.
Countless actors and crew members saw Terrence Young as a James Bond figure. Young was adventurous, stylish, handsome, refined, and possessed a charming dry wit. He was also a film director with an eye for action, an ear for dialogue, and a wonderful ability to communicate and collaborate with the film crews with which he worked. Special effects supervisor John Steers recalls.
Terrence Young, the first director, I mean, he was a phenomenal character. I mean, he would just actually get into your mind what he was thinking. I mean, and you do things for Terrence that you without thinking. I mean, you just do it, you know, because you knew that was what was necessary. In fact, there's very few directors after Terrence Young that I've had that feeling that I knew I was doing what he wanted.
How much are they paying?
But Terrence Young, he had that ability. He could tell every, even the sound people, everybody, exactly what he wanted and the sort of sound effects he wanted. Costume, wardrobe, he knew exactly what he wanted. And there was no halfways, and you knew you'd done it right.
Norman Wanstall discusses the collaborative nature of work on the early Bond films and how that contrasts to the individual responsibilities of each department head.
Generally speaking, every expert on a film crew is paid to do the job that they're meant to be good at. And that's hence why we have all the tedious credits, because all those people are experts in their own field. So even though it's a team job, making movies is without doubt a team job, everyone is expected to do the very best in their department. So if you're a soundtrack editor, your job is to produce what you feel is the very best you can for that particular any particular moment. If you're in any doubt, there's always people to consult. You can always call the director in and say, how do you feel about this? Is this the way you see it? And they would be pleased to contribute. But generally speaking, movies don't work like that. Everyone is working in their own little cubbyhole, especially the musician. He's off doing his stuff, and the sound effects editor's doing his, and the editor's doing his. And you hope that when they all come together, everything will work.
I should imagine.
In a case like that, I would know what I'm supposed to produce, and when we reached the dubbing theatre, we would all decide there and then whether or not it was working, and if it wasn't, or if the director had a particular viewpoint, then we would listen and try and adjust it accordingly. At the end of the day, the director is the king.
Now Terrence Young discusses one of the most famous fights in film history.
I did most of it myself. I used to be a boxer, and I was almost, I suppose, the equivalent of what you call an all-American football player. I played rugby football for, you know, international football. And I worked it out with a different stuntman. It wasn't Bob Simmons, it was somebody else. And originally, I worked it out with the two doubles. And I had the artist sitting by on the set watching. And when they said, come on, let us do that, I said, no, you boys will get hurt. You won't do it as well as the stuntmen. So after I'd said that to them about three or four times, and I'd shot two or three takes with the other artists, I could see that I had them where I wanted. And they said, come on, we'll do it ourselves. And they did. There's only one shot doubled in the whole of that fight. It was the whole of it done by the two boys. I shot the whole sequence in 2 days. It was very quick because it lasts about 6 minutes. I couldn't get too far away from the actors because I was shooting inside a railway compartment. And, we went from one railway compartment into the other one where the woman was sleeping. And, as I said, you had to be close. They had to be on top of you. And I think that helped enormously. It added enormously to the effectiveness of the scene. And it made it even more violent, the close contact all the time. In fact, the film was so violent, if I hadn't had the ending to it, again the censors would have clipped it.
Peter Hunt recalls how work progressed on the train fight sequence as production continued.
The train fight was really cinematic, but again, we had the advantage, you see, of shooting it over a period of time. I mean, the basis was shot with Terence and a couple of cameras. And then we put that together, and it was a small set, so it was easy to keep. It was kept there without any expense. And then I would put it all together, and then we would develop shots and extra things that would make it more exciting. This would all come about little by little. Then we'd do that, spend a morning or doing that. But the main part, of course, was, scripted and done. But the thing that turned it into a really exciting fight were the extra pieces that we could put in over a period of perhaps a week, maybe 2 weeks, with odd days, shooting extra inserts, extra pieces, extra jaw socks, fighting, all the various things. And it all managed through editing it like that and building it in the cutting rooms as films should be made, as Charlie Chaplin made his films. Terence would, wherever he could, leave out a close-up or something that he knew he had to have in a sequence and say, it's all right, dear boy, we'll do that later on, we'll do that later on. And then when it was all together, he would have the opportunity. Well, we desperately need this close-up. We know we always knew we needed that close-up. And at the same time, he would say, I do need some more shots or whatever, Shouldn't we put in this here and that there? And, of course, when they were scheduling the close-up, which had to be done desperately, he would manage to get extra shots and extra pieces. He was quite clever about that sort of way of shooting.
We are coming up on two sequences added to the film to create an action climax. In the novel, Bond drags Tanya off the Orient Express at Dijon, France, without incident. The filmmakers wanted a more explosive climax, and writer Richard Maybaum devised two sequences.
Where are you?
The first is an attack by Spectre henchmen in a helicopter, which both Maybaum and Terence Young freely admitted was inspired by the famed crop duster sequence in North by Northwest. The sequence has some clever twists on Hitchcock's classic, becoming a taut game of strategy between Bond and the Spectre agents. The second sequence, where Bond and Tanya are chased across the Gulf of Venice in boats, was inspired by a scene in a script by Richard Maybaum in a film directed by Terence Young called The Red Beret, which was produced by Cubby Broccoli. The scene has Alan Ladd trapped in a minefield. A bazooka is fired, and it skips across the surface of the ground, setting off many of the mines, creating a series of explosions. With the mines detonated, the good guys have a way to escape from the trap. Notice the clever visual coming up, where Bond literally gives his maiden a bed of roses to sleep upon. Now back to editor Peter Hunt, who discusses how the different styles of Hitchcock and Terence Young allow them to look at similar material and arrive at totally different creative results.
Hitchcock worked everything out. Hitchcock was an art director, and he storyboarded everything for himself beforehand, so he knew exactly how it was going to work. And in doing so, he limited the editing of it so that it would work just as he had storyboarded it. That way you can't do what I do, because all he's going to do is to shoot what he wants, and that's it. The helicopter chase in From Russia With Love was different insofar as that it was a conglomeration of a number of shots which had to be got under several conditions, and creativity about editing it. Terence used to work from, you know, the moment, the situation as it was at the time, and would deliver you a great deal of material which was covering the story sequence. So you had to make it work. You had to work at it. You had to look at it and try and make out how the situations could be developed with the material that he gave you. Now, he knew that he often did it that way, and it pleased him to do it that way. It worked for his personality and what have you. But it did make it hard work. It did make it an effort on your part to make it work in the way that he thought that it should go. Now, we had such a relationship and a rapport, and I liked him so much that he never upset me at any time. Whatever outrageous things I did with his material, he never said, oh, that's not how I wanted it, all that sort of thing, some directors would do. He always encouraged one. He was always full of, that's great, let's do this. And that is how we would develop certain sequences and make them even better and better.
To blow up a helicopter in midair, John Steers built a radio-controlled miniature. Steers refers to radio control as RC.
The helicopter you saw in the film was a miniature, obviously. I think it was the first time that had been attempted. It was about 6 feet long, and I knew I had a little commercial petrol engine inside it. RC was not really to a state at the time that you could depend on it totally, but it was partially RC'd. What I did actually, I put negative instance on the rotor, but it had an airfoil section, so it, in fact it didn't flip under, so that it stabilised itself and actually lifted. And the tail rotor I trimmed to hold it in a stable condition laterally, but what we did, because we had to feed the pyros to it, I wouldn't trust the radio at the time to do it with radio controlled explosions. I did feed a cable down through the main rotor, another one through onto the tail rotor. That was purely to take the electrical current for the explosion. But the thing virtually was flying itself, and those two wires actually were for the pyros, basically. That's the first time a model helicopter has been used like that. That actually was a shot which we did by lunchtime. Terence Young came up to me, he said, can we shoot the helicopter? It's a lovely day, lovely sky, John. I said, sure, let's do it now. So he said, okay, fine. So off we went, and we did it, and that's the result.
When the helicopter does crash in the film, Bond utters the line, I'd say one of their aircraft is missing. The line is an in-joke, provided by production designer Sid Kane. The war drama, One of Our Aircraft is Missing, was the movie which brought Kane into the film industry. For Sean Connery, From Russia With Love proved to be a turning point, where he moved from being the little-known star of Dr. No to a leading man with real presence. Dana Broccoli remembers Connery's anxiousness to make his mark in other non-Bond films.
Sean was anxious to do other films, and although he had a contract to do a non-Bond film with Harry and Cubby, Cubby decided, since he was unhappy, to let him out of that part of the contract. And then he asked Sean what he would really like. He said, I'd like to work with Hitchcock. So Cubby picked up the phone and he spoke to Hitchcock and he said, oh, I'd be delighted to use him, be marvelous. And he did make a film with Hitchcock.
Connery's film with Hitchcock, the psychological drama Marnie was not well received by critics at the time of its release, but it has since become regarded by many as a classic. Now we return to Blofeld on his yacht. Notice in this shot the back of Blofeld's head in the upper right corner, where actor Anthony Dawson's black hair can be seen. This would be the last time Blofeld would sport hair until 1971's Diamonds Are Forever, when actor Charles Gray would take over the role. We are now about to witness the death of Kronstein, played expertly by Polish-born actor Vladek Szabal. Szabal was in his teens when Poland was invaded by the Nazis in World War II. He worked with the resistance and was imprisoned by the Germans, escaping twice. In 1951, Szabal won the National Acting Prize in Poland and then immigrated to England to study film production. His papers did not allow him to pursue acting work, and he quickly was forced to take menial jobs. Soon, the Oxford Dramatic Society asked him to mount productions for them, and Szabal became a fixture in the British drama circles, renowned as a teacher and performer. Szabal did not want to take the role in From Russia with Love. He later claimed that he did not like the script or the part, but he was friends with Sean Connery's wife, Diane Tolento, and Connery had suggested him for Kronstein, so Szabal relented. He would later claim that From Russia with Love, quote, would change my whole life, unquote. Vladek Szabal went on to play many roles in spy films of the 60s and 70s, including a comic turn in the 1967 unofficial James Bond spoof, Casino Royale.
Number three.
He passed away in 1992 in his adopted home of England.
There will be no delay, number one. There's still time.
Now back to Norman Wanstall, who discusses the difficulties of finding just the right sound for the boats.
The sound mixer who went on location with the crew was determined that he would bring back ample tracks of those fairy marine craft. He became one of the crew, and they just dressed him up in a cap and a sweater, and he's in fact in front of one of the boats, and he was recording. But when we ran them all, to my horror, I realized that these boats were so refined, so highly tuned, that they sounded more like vacuum cleaners. I knew that Bond films would not accept such a sound. They had to have a roar. We had to feel that these turbocharged, roaring monsters. And it just so happened that he recorded one of these going off from the harbour. And it started up with a tremendous roar, and you had all the exhaust as it drove away. And that one track was what I really dreamed about. That's the sound I heard these boats making. And that became the basis of the whole scene.
The boat chase here at the end of the film proved to be one of the most difficult scenes to shoot in any Bond film. First, the crew tried to shoot the scene near Istanbul. They were plagued by weather delays, choppy seas, and notoriously slow boats, which made the resulting footage look tame. Finally, a leased camera boat sank on the Bosphorus, and the producers decided to shoot the sequence in Scotland. Yet bad luck followed the crew. 10 days were allotted for the Scottish locations, but when director Terence Young and assistant art director Michael White were involved in a helicopter crash, the crew slipped 5 days behind schedule, not because of injuries, but because they had to wait on a new helicopter. Weather also proved to be a problem, particularly when it came to the final explosion, as Walter Gotell remembers.
Believe it or not, we took a week to be able to shoot this due to Cubby Broccoli's determination to get the wind from the right direction. Nothing else to be shot. We'd shot it all and literally played chess at Cubby Broccoli's expense and his utter grit, guts and determination to get the right ending for his film.
Keep your hands up, Mr. Bond. We're sending a boat along to take you off.
We are now in the paddock tank at Pinewood Studios, where all the post-explosion fire was staged. Despite controlled conditions, the fire and explosions got out of hand, as Walter Gotell recalls.
It was, nevertheless, a hell of an experience, because my eyelids were burnt off, because I insisted on doing it myself. They offered me a stuntman, but I said, what for? It was, to my mind, one of the best endings to a Bond film.
A careful listener will recall that this music was originally heard at the climax of the first Bond film, Dr. No. This final boat explosion was one of the final shots filmed in the movie. The blast was so large that, according to an Eon Productions press release from 1963, it rattled dishes in the studio commissary. The same press release also announced that the fire in the tank seriously burned three stuntmen. We are now on a stage at Pinewood Studios, where Lotta Lynya solidifies her position as one of the great Bond villains.
Send a reporter for the luggage, thank you. Avanti!
Lynya did not appear in many films. She performed in the 1930 German version of Three Penny Opera and did not return in front of movie cameras until 1961 in The Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone, where she played the delightfully decadent woman who manages a stable of gigolos. She was nominated for an Academy Award for the role. In 1963, she took on the role of Rosa Klebb in From Rush with Love. According to biographer Donald Spotto, she weighed just over 100 pounds at the time, and the costumers originally built her clothes with padding. The New York Post reported that she balked at the idea, saying she could play the part in such a way that she would not look weak or small. Her last film was Semi-Tough, where she gives Burt Reynolds a sadistic massage. Lotta Lynya passed away in 1981. Despite her fame as a singer and stage performer, and even the celebrity of the Academy Award nomination, she often remarked that it was her appearance in the Bond film that people remembered best. She was certainly remembered with fondness by the cast and crew. In the novel, this scene takes place between Bond and Klebb in the Ritz Hotel in Paris. It is Klebb's suite, and she awaits Bond with a gun built into a telephone and poison-tipped knitting needles. Bond pins her to the wall with a chair, but as Klebb is being taken away by the French agents assisting Bond, Klebb kicks him with her poison-tipped shoe. As the novel closes, Bond collapses to the floor. Many critics have speculated that Fleming intended to kill Bond with that scene, but the truth is very different. By the time From Rush with Love was published, Fleming had already written the first draft of his next Bond novel, Dr. No. Far from trying to kill Bond off, Fleming merely followed in the footsteps of storytellers such as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and others, creating a cliffhanger ending. The film of From Russia with Love premiered at the London Pavilion Cinema on October 10, 1963. Ian Fleming held a party afterwards where he served beluga caviar to his guests. The premiere itself proved to be a thundering success, filled with glamour. Actress Alicia Gurr recalls the event.
The London premiere of From Russia with Love. Wow. First of all, they had a poster on Piccadilly Circus that was about six story high of myself and Martine Beswick with Sean. I have never seen myself so big. And I remember driving around and around Piccadilly Circus looking at that poster and going, wow. I have been to so many premieres, but never have I seen that much of a crowd. We were lucky, for Russia with Love came after Dr. No, and Dr. No was a sensation. Sean Connery, Ursula, gorgeous Ursula. And we were lucky to be right after them. And there was, amazingly enough, already huge cult of Bond lovers. That premiere, from Leicester Square to Piccadilly Circus, took 1 hour for the limo to make its way through. And you know you can walk it in 2 minutes. It was a fabulous premiere, fabulous. And to see the picture and hear the applause during the picture and the enthusiasm, I knew, I walked out and I said, wow, this picture will stay forever. And it did. It really did.
Now a final comment from director Terence Young.
From Russia with Love is, in my opinion, far and away the best of all the Bond pictures. Sounds arrogant, but I'm sure it's true. We had just the right enough money at that time. We had $2 million, and it was, I had everything I wanted.
We hope you've enjoyed this audio commentary for From Russia with Love. We'd like to thank all those actors and crew members who provided us with interviews and all those who conducted these interviews and helped us document these stories. Particularly, we want to thank Steve Morey, who provided us with his interview with Terence Young. This audio commentary was produced by David Naylor and Bruce Sifley. I'm John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation. This is the end of the From Russia With Love audio commentary.
To Russia I flew, but there and then I suddenly knew you'd care again. My running around is through. I fly to you.